the way they operate has been called fortress conservation. It means they defend the parks like a fortress, like a castle against the evil outside world, which are the people.
Follow the money.
This is the podcast of the European Investigative Newsroom, Follow the Money. I'm your host, Emmerich Chatinier, and as always, I'm joined by Follow the Money reporter and my co-host, Alexander Fanta in Vienna. Good morning, Alex.
Hello, good morning.
In today's episode, we follow a Belgian prince into the Congolese jungle. There, rebel fighters, Bitcoin, and European development aid come crashing together. Our colleague Olivier van Beeme has been digging into the dark sides of European meddling in Africa for years. Today, he'll tell us how he uncovered how EU aid money went into funding Bitcoin mining in the Congo. Welcome, Olivier.
Hello, good morning.
Olivier, you have written 3 books about the continent, 2 about the beer company Heineken, and most recently 1 about the organization African Parks. And can you start by telling us a little bit more about what your latest book is about?
Yeah, it's called in Dutch, Ondernemers in het Wild, Entrepreneurs in the Wild. It has been translated into to German and French, but unfortunately not into English yet. It's a book about an organization, African Parks, that presents itself kind of as a savior of wildlife in on the African continent, of national parks. It's very convincing. So many philanthropists, billionaires, and also institutions like the European Union, up until recently USAID, were supporting African Parks in a very important way. And I show in my book that it's not all that rosy, that African Parks is actually a very controversial organization. The way they operate has been called fortress conservation. It means they defend the parks like a fortress, like a castle against the evil outside world, which are the people living there, basically. They adapt a militarized way of conservation. So with heavy weaponry, they try to protect the parks against the outside world.
Next to your books, you have recently written 2 pieces on the same topic for Follow the Money, specifically about a park called Virunga. Could you share what you uncovered about Virunga?
Yeah, Virunga is a park in eastern Congo, a very famous park. The EU has spent 157 million euros on it over the years, which is really for conservation an enormous amount of money on one park. Emmanuel de Merode, the Belgian prince who manages Virunga and the organization that manages Virunga, have really succeeded in making people believe that their approach is very successful. But in reality, you can really question that. If you look at the numbers, if you look at what's happening, if you look at what people who live in the vicinity of the park will tell you, yeah, it's basically very different.
We'll get into the exact details of the controversy that you're describing here. And perhaps before we do that, what is this park? Where is Virunga? What is it like? What should we know about it?
Yeah, Virunga is a very beautiful place in eastern Congo. It's one of the most famous parks on the African continent. It was made famous also by a Netflix documentary that was released in 2014. It has so many things. It has volcanoes. The Nyiragongo is the most famous one. There are silverback mountain gorillas, a highly threatened species that's only living in Virunga and in 2 parks in Rwanda and Uganda. So it's the first national park on the African continent. It was declared a national park back in 1925. So this year it celebrates its centenary. And it was first called Parc Albert after the then Belgian king. Congo was a Belgian colony in those days. So this is the park. It's also a very violent place.
And speaking about that violence, because as we've said before, it's also a region plagued by a lot of conflict. What can you tell us about the conflict in the park and the wider region?
Eastern Congo is one of the most unstable regions in the world. There's a conflict taking place there since the late 90s. And these days, it's very active again. There's a rebel movement, M23, that has occupied a large part of Eastern Congo. But it's also other organizations. The park is actually full of rebel groups, and some of them have a distinct ideology. Others are more bandits. There's a lot happening there. It's a very violent place, actually.
So Olivier, so you're basically saying this is a park full of extreme nature treasures, active volcanoes, gorillas, but at the same time, there's also guerrilla forces fighting within the park.
Yeah. It's a very tough place. It's a difficult place. There's these rebels that there are thousands of them living inside the park, having their base inside the park. And then you have this wildlife that needs to be protected. You have, it's also a very densely populated area. In the near vicinity of the park, there are about 5 million people living, and sometimes the head of the park even says that there are 11 million people who are kind of rely on the park. So all this comes together in this one spot.
You were telling us earlier about this term fortress conservation. Is that also something that you see in the case of Virunga?
Yeah, very much so. It's the approach is quite similar. The park gets protected by rangers who have weapons and who are often in conflict with the people around the park. And I think it's very important. That's one of the discoveries that I did during my research on the book on African parks as well, is that we in the West, we consider poachers as pure evil. We see them as the people who kill elephants for their tusks or rhinos for their horns. But in reality, it is more complicated than that. By far, most of the poachers are from a very different category. They are just poaching some smaller animals for their own subsistence, for a little bit of trade. They can be chopping wood. They can be fisher. If they do illegal fishing, that's also considered poachers. So everything that's illegal is considered poaching. And it can often be punished in a very severe way. So that's what's creating a lot of tension in an area such as Virunga.
And in the middle of it all, we have luxury tourism.
Yeah, Emmanuel de Merode, the Belgian prince who is heading the park, he really wanted to develop tourism in the park as a source of revenue. The park wants to be... They rely heavily on European money, on money from the European Union. They rely on billionaires, but this flow of money could stop. So ideally, they would generate as much income themselves as possible. And one of the options they've been very seriously looking into is tourism. And this is actually complicated because it is a war zone. But how they arranged it, and this kind of took off in the early 2010s, so just over 10, 12 years ago. They built lodges, safari lodges for tourists, and they would bring tourists from the Rwandan border. So it's very close to the border with Rwanda, and Rwanda is considered a stable country. It's authoritarian but stable, so it's safe to go to the Rwandan-Congo border. And then tourists would be brought on kind of an escort to the park without setting foot on Congolese soil, actually.
And how many tourists are we talking about here?
Virunga said, We welcomed 17,000 tourists in 4 years, but other people say that there were up to 10,000 tourists per year. Well, it's still very low numbers. If you look at one day in a zoo in Amsterdam, or it's more, but still, it's these tourists, they pay up to $800 or even $1,000 per day, so it can be a substantial source of income. But yeah, it's a very high risk, of course, to invest in tourism development in such a turbulent area. And what happened was that In 2018, 2017 was the peak for tourism in Virunga. 2018, there were two British tourists who were kidnapped. And this was, of course, a major blow to tourism. The ranger that tried to protect them was actually killed. And the park closed for the remainder of the year. So it was a heavy blow to tourism. Since then, there has been this M23 that really conquered much of the region, and a large part of Eastern Congo and of the park as well is not controlled by government anymore. So tourism is impossible. So ever since 2018, there's hardly been any tourists in Virunga.
And what's also a very interesting aspect here, you have already mentioned his name, is that this park is in fact run by a Belgian prince. Who is this Belgian prince?
Yeah, well, his name is Emmanuel de Merode. He's 55 years old. And let me state clearly that he is a Belgian prince, but it's an honorary title. So he is not officially part of the royal family. We will not see him on the Belgian throne one day. But he has this honorary title that he uses himself as well. So he has a background in anthropology, and he has done quite a few projects in different African countries. He has also worked with the EU and other institutions. He has a lot of experience in Congo, even prior to managing the park that he is now managing. In the early 2000s, the EU was already supporting the park and other parks in Africa, and they wanted to get the management out of the hands of African governments. In the case of Virunga, there's a public-private partnership. So management decisions are taken by the Virunga Foundation, and they are basically running the park.
And of course, we're talking about a Belgian prince here in an ex-Belgian colony. It's kind of hard to ignore this sense of like, what do these colonial ties mean here?
Yeah.
How do you look at that?
No, it's a very important subject, and I spoke to many people around the park, and they bring it up themselves as well. It's not something that we in the West are only talking about, but yeah, people see some sort of a continuity, like the Belgians were governing Congo up until 1960. Sometime in the late 19th century, it was called the Congo Free State. It wasn't even a proper colony, but it was owned by the Belgian king. It was really, Congo has a really strange and brutal history. So the fact that there's now a Belgian prince ruling the former Parc Albert, now called Parc de Virunga, is seen as, do the Belgians still tell us what to do and what not by quite a few people?
And so how did he manage to get funded by the EU for running this project?
Yeah, well, he had been involved with the EU already. So he knew, probably knew the right people, and he was involved in development programs in Congo already. So there was no tender. The EU really wanted Emmanuel de Merode to do it.
And as you mentioned, there's a Netflix documentary about the park produced by no less than Leonardo DiCaprio. And there's a very interesting scene where the prince, at a time when there's also a lot of fighting, and then he says, our role is simply to stay here to watch over the station, which is there for the park. If they come here, they being the rebels, we cannot fight against them. I will be the last one to leave. So that whole outbreak of fighting happened many times throughout the prince's management, right?
Yeah. Well, that was also a time when the same organization, M23, they controlled part of the Eastern Congo back then as well. Merode also kind of has this heroic role. So he was opposing rebels. He was opposing this oil company that was there. So he comes across as really brave in the documentary. And for tourists. I've been on the TripAdvisor site to read reviews of the Mikeno Lodge that is close to headquarters. Like, some of the people really, they meet with the Merode and it's like a dream coming true to them. It's he's almost an attraction himself in a way. So those were kind of the heydays for tourism, even though, as I said previously, the numbers are very small, a few thousand people per year. But that the idea was that tourism could really lift up and create a sustainable stream of income for the park.
And so one of the ways to develop the local economy was tourism, which we have already talked about. And then there's also this idea of generating green energy, right? That was also one of his projects.
That's probably the most important one, where most money went into. The idea is to build hydroelectric plants. So three of them have been built. A fourth has almost been finished. And the idea is to generate cheap green power to boost economic activity and to give households access to this power as well. Emmanuel de Merode wanted to have 1 million people connected. So far, they've connected fewer than 40,000 households. So they're still very far away from their objectives. And there's also an objective. At some point in 2014, in an interview, he said we should create 60,000 sustainable jobs by 2020. But in all those years that he's been active, according to their own websites, they created only 11,000 jobs in all those years, which on a population of 5 million, it's no more than a drop in the ocean.
So in some hugely ambitious mission, but I think we can sort of conclude that mission hasn't really been successfully completed.
For the moment, according to his own objectives and the numbers that they communicate themselves, it's you can't consider it a success story. And then Emmanuel Merode himself came up with a plan to invite a Bitcoin company, a French Bitcoin company. So he met with a person called Sébastien Gouspillou. He has sometimes been called Bitcoin Indiana Jones because he looks for access to cheap energy at what we consider remote places like Tajikistan, Siberia. He's been around. And the thing with Bitcoin is Bitcoin mining, cryptocurrency, is finite. So there's a certain number of Bitcoins. And in order to get a Bitcoin, you need a huge amount of energy. And in some places where energy is expensive, it's not worth it anymore to look for them because the energy costs are so high. So people look for places where you have cheap energy. And with green energy, it's even better because you can say that your operation is not polluting, but that it's also a green way of digging Bitcoins. So Emmanuel de Merode invited Bitcoin Indiana Jones to come to Congo, and they made a deal that Gouspillou and his organization could come to Congo to create Bitcoin mines. So that's shipping containers with hundreds of computers in the rainforest next to this hydropower plant without clients. So this is the way they created a Bitcoin mine there that's now operative.
We're talking about energy that was supposed to go to people in the region and now goes instead to Bitcoin mining operation that produces money mainly for the park, but also for private enterprise.
Yes. Yeah.
And did you have anything to say about this? Were they okay with the prince deciding to use it for this? Or?
So according to a spokesperson for the European Commission, they only use off-peak hours, like surplus energy generated in off-peak hours. But I've spoken to Gouspillou himself, and then I've seen reports, and basically what the EU claims is in my view it's incorrect. And I think what's also quite striking is after I asked for the numbers, and this took a long time and several emails, but in the end the park sent me the numbers that the money that the Bitcoin mining was generating. And it was really, it was very low. At the best year, it was not even $500,000, whereas tourism generated at the best year $3.5 million. But for example, in the first half of this year, all this, this Bitcoin mining generated just over $100,000. So yeah, for running a park, it's not a lot of money.
I think it's important to remember how controversial Bitcoin mining actually is, because you know, you have to remember Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency. It is being used for many legitimate purposes, but it is also growing concern in, among governments in industrial countries that Bitcoin is used for corrupt practices. It is used to launder money. It is used to move money out of the grasp of tax authorities between countries. Another major concern about Bitcoin has been its high energy consumption. So by some estimates, Bitcoin uses up globally as much energy as the entire Czech Republic. It has an incredible, it has a big footprint in water consumption, because often water is used for cooling the mining rigs. You also have a lot of electrical waste from the massive server farms. So even if the energy used to mine Bitcoin in the Congo might be clean, any Bitcoin mining done anywhere in the world is contributing to these major challenges. So I think you're in ethically very gray area if you run a Bitcoin mine.
Yeah, yeah.
But this whole story starts with the EU funding tourism lodges in Virunga, and now we're at the point where the EU is funding Bitcoin mining through development aid.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, they don't fund directly. They provide the electricity. So it's not that Bitcoin organization gets subsidized. They have constructed the hydropower plant that's now being used by this Bitcoin company.
And how does this Bitcoin mining work out for the locals?
Well, some of them are a bit annoyed that they know that there's a power plant, but they don't get any energy from it. So that's a source of anger, annoyance. I spoke to a professor who knows quite a lot about it, and he told me about, like, even if it's green energy, you know, the fact that all the computers that have been built for it, all the transport, it's still a very polluting activity. And then the fact that they're using green energy, according to him, was more an aspect of greenwashing than a real green operation that's saving Virunga.
It almost sounds a bit as if, you know, kind of whatever actually happens on the ground, the EU has decided in advance that this is going to be a success story because it's run by this charismatic Belgian prince who has attracted, you know, kind of a lot of big names and brought together something that is seen as successful business venture. So in a way, it feels a bit like as if this project is too big to fail, isn't it, for the EU?
Yeah, I think it's a good analysis. It's also quite remarkable, I think, that there never has been a very in-depth evaluation of how the EU money and the EU has spent 157 million euros on it over the years, which is really, for conservation, an enormous amount of money on one park.
Yeah, because I think here it's also important to mention that this is not the end of the story. It's not like the EU said, this didn't work out the way we thought it would, so let's end our cooperation here. So the EU has actually granted new money to the Virunga Foundation, correct?
Indeed, now, despite the lack of success, the Virunga Foundation has been awarded management and implementation of a huge program. This program is called the Kivu-Kinshasa Green Corridor. Congo is a very big country, about the size of Western Europe. So it's a zone that's basically the size of France. It's 550,000 square kilometers. There's about 30 million people living inside it, including the capital Kinshasa. And indeed, despite all these questions that are being asked, the EU has said that it's a very good idea, that they've pledged 80 million euros for it earlier this year as well when it was announced. So the power of the Virunga Foundation and the Belgian prince, Emmanuel de Merode, who is heading it, is even getting bigger.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing your insights today, Olivier. And with that, we'll wrap up today's conversation. Alex and I will be back soon for another episode. You can find Olivier's story in the show notes and also on ftn.eu.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.